This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, we've had a very shocking week in politics, or a week and a half now. The departure of the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, and the new Taoiseach in waiting is something that nobody expected. Varadkar resigned, citing pressures that were public and private. There was no hint of anything untoward. But he was emotional when he made his speech. He had been in leader of Fine Gael for 7 years, and he looked and talked as if he was burnt out and had done his bit. He was, of course, a Fine Gael politician, and Fine Gael, in the present coalition arrangements, hold the office of Taoiseach. And, of course, the next Taoiseach will be Simon Harris, which will be quite a leap for him, but we'll see how that works out. Two pieces written in the last fortnight by Diarmaid Farrington are fascinating in the contexts of both the Varadkar departure and the referenda that were rejected by the people. Diarmaid, of course, is Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD and a weekly columnist with the Irish Times, always thought-provoking, and in particular when we come to momentous occasions. Diarmaid, thank you very much for joining us on The Stand. One of the things I wanted to ask you was, you wrote a fascinating piece about Leo Varadkar's departure. And in particular, you weren't sort of praising him so much as observing with commendable sort of neutrality, pointing out what was good and not so good. And one of the things, two of the things in particular that you admired about him in his time in office, was that he put a formal end to civil war politics. Now, that, I take it, is a reference to going into government with Fianna Fáil.
It was a reference to that. Yeah, I was looking back at some of his Dáil contributions, and he made the point that in many respects, for his generation, civil war politics had not been a burning issue, obviously, but that given the coming together of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil in power, that he was proud to be able to stand up in the Dáil and say that this now marks the formal end to civil war politics. Because obviously Fianna Fáil had been prepared to support a minority government, which really was, I suppose, the beginning of the end of civil war politics before they actually formally joined forces. But I was always interested, I suppose, in that younger generation, and they're younger than me now. Yeah, so I was starting to feel old, and I was looking at Varadkar and his generation, not just in Fine Gael, but specifically because he was a Fine Gael Taoiseach, and wondering what they made of the history of their party and the context in which it emerged, and indeed its predecessor party, Cumann na Gael, obviously, and how they viewed that. So it was partly a generational question, I suppose, and it wasn't that Leo Varadkar had to do a huge amount of work to heal divisions. I mean, this ultimately was a numbers game, and really what ended civil war politics was the fracturing that has been so apparent in recent times, that they weren't the two big dominant beasts to the extent that they had been. And I remember talking to you at one stage when we were looking at the 2020 general election.
Yes.
And we, you know, we were looking back at a time, not in the distant past, when both Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil were able combined to command well over 80% of the vote. So there's been a very significant fracturing there. And I also thought it was interesting to look at a younger politician who clearly was not in it for life.
Yes.
And yes, there was a lot of shock with the recent announcement. And I didn't see that coming so soon. But I do remember thinking when he assumed the leadership of Fine Gael that there was no way that he was going to be a politician for life. And that was very different, say, from the Civil War generation of politicians and even those who came after them, who tended to go into politics and see it as a lifelong career.
Yes, and one of the points you make that he generated a lot of international coverage because he was young, he was a gay man of Indian heritage. And this struck me because I'd been very struck by a piece you wrote, as I say, a couple of weeks ago about Fine Gael's origins. And one of the key people in that Civil War period, Richard Mulcahy, had said, and you quote him as saying, that, you know, decisions have to be made, votes have to be cast. He was of the view that the ordinary people of Ireland would always get their politics right in the long run. In other words, extremism, either left or right, wasn't on the agenda. And I would say that Bradker was proof of that, although he did talk, and you criticize him for talking about serving the people who get up early in the morning.
Yeah.
Forgetting, of course, yeah, that poor people would be getting up earlier maybe than some of the others early in the morning. But you do refer to that slogan, which I objected to at the time because it has connotations.
Oh, it has absolute connotations, and it's very deliberate, and it's loaded, and it's crass, and it's divisive, and it's thoroughly objectionable, in my view. But we have to look at the context there. In 2017, when Leo Varadkar was contesting the leadership, his opponent was Simon Coveney. Now, Simon Coveney invoked the just society tradition of Fine Gael, as he saw it. This was the proposals in the 1960s from a younger generation of Fine Gaelers, that they wanted to see more state intervention under a Fine Gael government to promote greater equality. And that appalled some of the old guard in Fine Gael. But they were trying to distinguish themselves really from Fianna Fáil, and the younger generation of Fine Gaelers were suggesting in the 1960s they needed to move in a new direction. Now, Simon Coveney invoked that idea of the just society against Leo Varadkar's idea of representing the people who got up early in the morning. And what I found interesting about that was that it goes to the heart, I suppose, of a degree of confusion or soul-searching about what Fine Gael's identity is that they've never fully resolved. A lot of members of the party were never really serious in the 1960s about the just society idea, and it was kind of quietly left to dissipate, and it certainly didn't win Fine Gael any extra seats in the 1965 general election. But at the same time, you will still hear people like Pascal Donoghue today saying that he is very proud of the Just Society, that he has a copy of the Just Society document in his office. It's his guiding compass, he has said, of his membership of Fine Gael. And yet, at the same time, he would be very adamant that globalization and the market is also in the DNA of Fine Gael. And you can see Simon Harris nodding to that constituency now by emphasizing the importance of Fine Gael prioritizing small businesses and private enterprise. And Varadkar did a lot of that as well. And I suppose the point I'm making is that they have drawn from the well in a very selective way, depending on which audience they are appealing to. Now, on the one hand, Varadkar could say, yes, look at what I symbolize. And he could do that quite genuinely. It wasn't easy for him to come out as a gay man live on radio when he did. And he could say that, I represent a new Ireland, a younger Ireland, a more tolerant Ireland, a more compassionate Ireland, a republic of opportunity, as he famously described it. And yet at the same time, he also, as leader of Fine Gael, wants to appeal to what he thinks is the base of Fine Gael. They've often talked about the need to shore up their base, and Simon Harris is engaging in a version of that now. And it's an interesting combination. You referred to Richard Mulcahy there. That yes. brings us all the way back to a century ago. And the context for Richard Mulcahy's remarks were really about the threats that existed to the survival of the state in 1924, because the ashes of the Civil War were still smouldering quite brightly.
And it had been very bitter, as all civil wars are.
It was very bitter, but there was also a crisis in Ireland in 1924 because there was a threatened mutiny in the army, and he was yes. Minister for Defence. And in fairness to him, he did step down in order to try and take the heat out of the situation. And he made this point about, you know, voters always getting things right, partly in the context of this idea of ensuring the survival of the state, that they would be committed to democracy, that they would not be led by those who wanted to subvert the state. Now, that yes. was a self-serving narrative, and it was part of a kind of a propaganda war about Cumann na Gael, later Fine Gael, being the party that saved the state. And, of course, there's a very proud ownership of that idea that they were there yes. during the very difficult years. And again, they sometimes still today draw on that, particularly when they're trying to, you know, make war with Sinn Féin and its claims around republicanism.
Yes.
So again, it's a very interesting inheritance. But there was that survival, I suppose, of those very difficult years in the 1920s. And, you know, Vrad Cartu, when he was leader, at the time, I suppose, of a lot of the commemorations of the revolutionary period. And he would have emphasized that he had a deep interest in the history as well. But I suppose the question becomes, at what stage do you say, well, that legacy or that lineage really isn't relevant to what we're facing in the 21st century?
Yes, indeed. And there's a question he answered not too long ago when he was asked about the difference between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. And you quote his answer, ethics and integrity in public office, end quote.
Well, so, I mean, the idea that Fianna Gael never had yeah. issue with ethics and integrity, of course, is something of a joke. I suppose yeah. the point was often made by Fianna Gaelers that Fianna Fáil were up to no good. Of course, Fianna Fáil spent, until recently, a lot longer in power than Fine Gael, and more associated with the temptations that came with abusing that power. But it's a very old answer to an old question. And, you know, Sean Lamass at one stage at a press conference in the 1950s was asked, what's the difference between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael? And it came just after Fianna Fáil had won the election. And he said, well, the difference is we're in and they're out. you know, there was no question of digging deep ideologically.
Yes.
And I mean, it's a very relevant question now. I mean, if you look at the state of the parties, according to pollsters now, both of the parties are pretty much on around 20%, you know, give or take yeah. 3 or 4% either way. And both of them are claiming that there's a need for them to have separate identities. There are a lot in Fianna Fáil who would like to present themselves as being left of centre, whilst they would depict Fine Gael as being right of centre. Pascal Donoghue has claimed his mission as a politician is to ensure that the centre holds, which is also what Enda Kenny would have claimed yes. was his mission after the upheaval of the economic crash and the great change that came with the 2011 general election. But it was really a change of numbers. Irish politics is overwhelmingly centrist. Now, you could see that in a very positive way, which brings us back to the point you started with.
Yeah, I don't mean to interrupt you, but we don't have here, I mean, the European elections are coming now in June. There is an expectation that there will be a big swing to the right across Europe. It's already happened in yeah. some jurisdictions. Sweden, for example, which was the model social democrat party, country rather, in Europe. And they've gone now quite far right. And we know about Hungary, we know about Poland. Italy has a neo-fascist prime minister. So this is a question I really want to ask you about. I cannot remember, or indeed conceive of, a far-right party here, a party of extremes. My own explanation for it is, and it's very helpful to read your pieces about this, Mulcahy's consideration of the moderate and common sense view Irish electors take of politics. But the point is, we don't have a right-wing press. We don't have, you know, the kind of press they have in England and elsewhere. We don't have an extremist politician. And in the recent past, we have had a movement of people who are alienated, agitated about immigration, trying to whip up what's described as right-wing, a right-wing movement.
Yeah.
They haven't got very far. And when you, as a historian, Dermot, particularly given your youth, really, comparatively, I mean, why have we never had the kind of party, the Tory party in Britain now, is thrashing around to match Nigel Farage and his new party, which is the Reform Party? We don't have that. I mean, France has Le Pen.
Yeah.
We don't have anything approaching that in this country. When I look across Europe now, and indeed when you look to the United States of America and the prospect of Donald Trump, who is, you know, well, we needn't go there, but we know what he is.
Yeah.
But he wouldn't get elected here.
No, and I mean, there are a number of different reasons for that. And if you consider the excesses of the 1930s, where democracy was in a very fragile position, think of all the successor states that came into being after the great upheavals of the First World War and the decline of the great empires, great being in inverted commas, of course. Very few of them survived as robust democracies. We are an exception in relation to that. Now, it wasn't that Irish politicians in the 1930s were not interested in what was going on internationally. They were. Many were appalled by it, particularly the rise of the right, the rise of authoritarianism. You had Owen O'Duffy, who was the Garda commissioner in 1933, who was intoxicated by Italy's Mussolini, and became involved in promoting an Irish version of these far-right movements. And that was faced down by the state. They were difficult years, and there was uncertainty as to how far Owen O'Duffy could take this crusade. It was partly a hangover from the Civil War as well, and the distrust of Fianna Fáil, because the losing side of the Civil War had come to power less than 10 years later. But the Blue Shirts were faced down by the state, and they were essentially snuffed out, and then those who were involved, many of them went back into kind of mainstream politics. But the important point was that there was a determination, particularly in a post-Civil War society, that they would not be allowed to gain a foothold. And both sides of the Civil War, whatever they were divided on, they were very committed to the idea of making constitutional politics work. And that's a very important post-colonial development, and it's very important post-Civil War development. You also had people in Ireland taking the business of politics very seriously and engaging with it very seriously. And that tradition, again, is a very long one. You can go right back to the year of Daniel O'Connell in an earlier part of the 19th century to see how you can mobilise people to become engaged in politics. And the longer the tradition you have, the more likely you are to, you know, have a mature engagement with politics. What we also didn't have that has facilitated resentment and the rise of the right in other countries was a significant movement of people into the country until very, very recently.
Yes.
We were a people who left this island.
Yes.
That has been the great historical reversal in recent years. And there are those on the right who see Ireland as fertile ground now to try and grow their anti-immigration campaigns and to build the right. They haven't, as you have said, they haven't got that far, but they perhaps have the potential to take it further. But we haven't seen evidence on a broad scale yet that is going to translate into a very large political movement. And that, again, is partly because Irish people are conscious, too, of our own history. You know, people who are trying to build political movements on the back of anti-immigrant sentiment, of course, can always be reminded of what the Irish have experienced historically. That may be a factor in it. But also those who are conscious of the extent to which they still need to take the business of politics seriously. You mentioned Britain and the United States and what's going on in other parts of Europe. Some of those countries, not Britain and the United States, but some of those other European countries are still dealing with the aftermath of a relatively recent conversion to democracy, as we understand it.
They're living indeed. In the Poland and Hungary would come to, which were under the tyranny of the Soviet Empire.
But there were also a lot of sentiments that were artificially kept under wraps during authoritarian regimes, which can then kind of bubble to the surface at a later stage. And that's really very relevant to nationalism as well. Whereas, you know, we have had a more comfortable experience with that in terms of, you know, gaining our independence over 100 years ago and, you know, coming to terms with the nationalist legacy and improving Anglo-Irish relations. But at the same time, we have also not opted for the kind of anti-politics that is represented, say, by the Conservative Party that you talk about and Boris Johnson. I watched with fascination the Channel 4 series there, the four-part series.
Yeah, we watched it here and it was fascinating.
But what's really fascinating is that Boris Johnson had absolutely no political ideas or sense of politics or sense of public service. And yet, at the same time, he was able to build a remarkable allegiance, or you know, build that sense of himself as somebody who's not really a politician. Now, Blair himself would have been somebody who admitted that he did not really see himself as a politician, but he was canny enough to still have a strong sense of the business of politics or some semblance of political service. But an awful lot of the currents that were running through British politics, and particularly in the Tory party, were working against that idea that you need to conduct your political business through the normal political channels, that you can really go outside of them and that you can rely on kind of baser instincts. You know, we haven't got to that level, and I don't think we are, certainly in the short term, going to get to that level. We still have quite a civilized form of political discourse and political debate in this country. We may dislike different politicians and different policies. We may have fierce arguments and rows over the failures, particularly the failures of the social contract. But by and large, we still believe in the business of politics and trying to bring about change through politics, rather than trying to bypass that and indeed bypass politics and representative institutions and solely conduct our business in a populist way, or indeed through social media. And we can see, when you go back to Peter Mayer, you may have heard of Peter Mayer, was a renowned political scientist from Ireland who really wrote about international politics as well. But he wrote a book in 2013 called Ruling the Void, about this worrying development where political sentiment was being channeled through new avenues, dangerous avenues. And he made the point that that was the responsibility too of political classes in various countries for not properly connecting with their audiences. But we can see what's filling that void now. It's being filled with bile. I mean, we're going to witness an American presidential election.
Yeah, I mean, racism, and this is where the immigration comes in, hatred of Muslims, hatred of black African people, hatred all round. And it's the dish of the day, every day in the House of Commons. And their latest trick is that when they stop these boats, the people who are apprehended and after due process will be put on a flight to Rwanda. I mean, it's a sick idea. It's a crazy idea. It's a racist idea. And it's impossible to imagine it being even raised here, and that kind of sentiment being whipped up and yielding results, which is why the Tory...
But you'll remember from your own time in England, Eamon, I mean, the race question in Britain has always been very complicated, and there are times when it got very toxic, particularly with the decline of the empire and the arrival of migrants into Britain from former Commonwealth countries and the race riots that were a part of that. So it is a theme that they have been dealing with for a long time. But the way in which it is being used now and the way in which in particular it fed into this idea of an English nationalism that was also connected to the idea of Brexit and Europe being the problem. And that we need to revert to a kind of a cultural and race self-sufficiency. you know, they're drawing on long-standing strains and really widening them.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Let me just ask you a final question, Dermot, especially because as a historian, you will no doubt enlighten us. Can you say what makes us different and more moderate in our approach to politics? And also, we don't want to be praising ourselves, patting ourselves on the back and all of that. It wouldn't be very nice. But should we be proud that we can, as a nation, at the same time that we are going way further than most nations in supporting the Palestinian people right at this minute, and also that we live in a tolerant society and we live in a society where we don't hate people. There is no hate culture here.
I think that is something that we can be proud of. And we don't want to be too self-congratulatory
because I've never been accused of it.
No, because we have many failings and we have a serious problem really with kind of honouring our sense of the social contract, which is also supposed to be about our innate decency. And there are many aspects of that that we have got badly wrong, and many of our politicians have got badly wrong.
But at the same, housing spring to mind.
Yeah, and obviously, and I mean, they are huge issues, and they can develop a cynicism about the ability of a political class to come up with solutions, and the reliance really on the forces of globalization and what we think or what is often presented as making our economy great. But at the same time, you know, we do need to take that long view. That's what I try and do, I suppose, when I'm looking at current political developments or controversies, is take that long view and say, well, you know, we had huge upheaval in Ireland in the late 19th and the early 20th century, partly about the struggle against colonialism, a war of independence, but also a social revolution, the land war, the degree to which we took that very seriously, the idea of house ownership, the idea of land ownership, which also made for a conservative political class, but a high degree of political stability. And that stability endured. And even I mentioned earlier on about kind of coming out of the Civil War period, coming up to the period of the Second World War, we were not going to be dragged into an international conflict against our will. And there was broad political consensus about vital issues like that.
Yes.
There was also a huge consensus around the idea of Ireland having a future within a European Union, what was the original European Economic Community. And that also spoke of a kind of a political consensus around some of the big questions that have divided other countries. And there is a moderate, a moderation around that. And there is a consensus and a political stability around that. And we are dealing with those inheritances, which can be very positive in terms of the way in which the business of politics is conducted, but also that we are not tearing ourselves apart on some of the big vital questions when it comes to our engagement with the world. And yet there is pride, I still think, in the idea of being able to exercise an independent foreign policy. Now, you could rubbish that by arguing that, well, hang on, you know, by joining a European Union, you're quite clearly open to the idea of compromising your foreign policy independence. Yes. Or by courting America or foreign money to the extent that you do. And many people would deride the idea that Ireland's in any way meaningfully neutral. And yet, it has been consistently shown that Irish people take whatever their definition of neutrality is seriously. And it's also quite clear that Israel has, right since the 1980s, identified Ireland as being the most hostile country in Europe to their approach to Palestine. And I think that's something, of course, that Irish people would wear as a badge of honour, particularly given what has been being witnessed at the moment. So that there is a relevance there to our history, to the backdrop of what we experienced. It doesn't mean that we experienced the horrible destruction or the excesses that were perpetrated against other people, but that we do have that sense of being a small country in the shadow of a much larger and more powerful neighbour, and that we can bring that sensibility or that sense of history to bear on modern problems. Now, there's no point in us deluding ourselves about our effectiveness. You know, it's always the case that when Ireland wants to try and make an impact internationally, it'll try and get a seat on the UN Security Council, or it'll do its utmost to try and emphasize that it does have a relevance in international affairs. There are strands that have been worked on. Irish diplomats have been quite effective in many ways in trying to get Ireland a voice that is louder than its size. And yet there are limits, of course, to what you can do with that. But the important point about how we're framing this discussion today is that Irish people do take those things seriously, and they have often very trenchant views on them. And that can be seen as a very healthy thing as well, I think.
Right. Well, on Easter weekend, it's nice to give ourselves a small pat on the back.
And I would say, just to finish on Easter weekend as well, Eamon, that it was Easter 75 years ago the Declaration of the Republic, the formal Republic of Ireland, came into being. And I think we're heading into a very interesting and perhaps quite difficult stage now over defining, well, what does a republic and what does republican for us mean 75 years on in relation to these political questions that we've been talking about, but also in relation to what constitute republican values for us at this stage.
Okay, Dermot, it's always fascinating to talk to you. Dermot Ferreter is Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD, and he writes a regular column every Friday in the Irish Times, invariably fascinating, particularly in the last 30 minutes. We're very grateful to Dermot Ferreter, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free
or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.